They come from somebody's basement, somebody lying down on a bed, looking at the ceiling, and suddenly realizing this. Somebody, it's sitting in a car. I don't know if you know this, but there's a guy sitting in a car, and the rain was falling on the windshield, and he's just like, man, we had something that moved. This would be so practical. And created the winds, the wipers. And Ford tried to steal it, and then he won it back, and so good for him. But creative ideas are all inside us all the time. And God really created us to be really creative. The difficulty is that creative people sometimes find that being too creative can cause some kind of problems, because you have to have the ability to try and be willing to fail through that. So I was reading, every now and again you follow on Twitter and somebody will post on there a great website, a great article, and I came across this tweet from Spectrum, and they had an article on Des Ford. Now, I don't know if you've ever read anything Des Ford's ever written. I myself have not done tons of research on that. I was a child when it happened, and I just remember a certain level of anguish hearing about, 200-300 pastors resigning and all this kind of stuff. So I thought I'd read the article, because Spectrum did an article, and then they pointed to a resource that Des Ford had come out with, trying to explain his perspective on this. And there's a quote from Ellen White in the very first section here that I want to read to you. It says this, found in the Councils to Writers and Editors on page 35. There's no excuse for anyone taking the position that there is no more truth to be revealed, and that all expositions of Scripture are without error. The fact that certain doctrines have been held as truth for years is not proof that our ideas are infallible. Age will not make error into truth, and truth can afford to be fair. If the pillars of our faith will not stand investigation, it's time we knew it. And I thought, wow, that's phenomenal. That's phenomenal. I'm glad we don't do that anymore. I'm glad we do. In small places, and we need to, and it's a huge, huge thing for us. But we do need to be able to say that we should ask hard questions. This is the tension that we have in the church, in my opinion. You've heard the phrase, "the tail that wags the dog." The question is the local church the tail, or is the local church the dog? And I think originally the local church was the dog. The local church now is the tail, and it's wagging like crazy. And the system is saying, we're comfortable, and we're here, and we're not really budging any particular way. And somehow we have to move the church back to being the dog, and the system being the tail, saying, hey, we see the global perspective. We see big picture things that you as a local church need to think about and be aware of. And if we did that, we would probably be in a healthier place. So I have four questions that I want you to look at. And these four questions are inside your sheet. So if you turn inside your packs, there are a few people who came in a little bit later and they didn't have any packs. So if you had a pack next to you that's not being used, just raise it right now. And we'll make sure that there's a pack back here. Those are a few packs back here. What we need is probably Patty. If you can help me grab these packs that are not being used, then those who don't have one at the back can grab one of those as well. And I have four questions for you guys that I want to address. And the first one is this. Create vision. Create vision. How do we do that? Vision is a very loaded word, right? When we think of vision, we may think of text in Proverbs, and we misunderstand the context of Proverbs, where vision is used more to actually be a restrainer than actually something pushing forward. When we think of vision, we often end up in prophetic language, and we think of prophetic language always talking only of the future. But in fact, actually, I feel vision probably is the question that has to be asked, is where are we going? And that's a very popular one. My church members will often say to me, well, what's your vision for Boulder Church? And honestly, I don't want to tell them that I have no vision. But today I confess that the vision is saying I'm dissatisfied with the present. That's what it comes down to. I don't know where we're going to go in the sense of I'm not able to say in 6 months' time we'll be exactly here. I can tell you I'm dissatisfied with what we've got going on, and we will fix what we've got going on here. But you can't create vision without visiting people, without getting to know their stories, without actually hearing where they came from and what's going on in their lives. And when you piece all these pieces together, then you start to understand that everybody is dissatisfied with what's going on in some shape or form. We just pretend that everything's fine. So vision has to have a certain level of urgency to it. It has to be so terrible and so heavy for us that we'll walk into the temple and say, the injustice is too much, I will overturn the tables. That's heavy vision. You don't know where it's going to go, but you know that right now there are people oppressed, and you will do something with that. Vision also is about resiliency. It's about the ability to be able to say, I'm going to be Noah, and I'm going to preach for 120 years, and I'm going to have the worst sermon evals that you could ever imagine, but I'm going to keep on doing this because through the hardship, I'm going to come out somewhere with this. I'm going to be Moses, and I'm going to go out, and I'm going to try my own way, which is I'm probably going to murder someone. I know we've all thought it. And then through that, I'm going to go to the wilderness and learn through that wilderness experience just how to become somebody in humility, because that's where I'm going to learn my vision. It's going to be like David, where you're going to relearn. David actually wrote by hand his note that he sent to through Uriah to Joab to kill him. It was the handwriting. It was a very significant fact that he wrote it with his hand. Just like later on, you'll read later on, other people write notes. Jezebel writes a note. It's very serious actions taking place. And going through that, he learned a tremendous amount of humility as he came out of that kind of experience. You notice that people never talked about the Messiah being from the line of Solomon. They talked about the Messiah being from the line of David. Even though when they're in exile, they look to Solomon. Because in exile, they just wanted the riches. But in reality, what they were hoping for was the Messiah from the line of David. Or maybe you're going to be like Elijah, where you can do so well and so long, and then somebody comes along, just one person. Her name doesn't happen to be Jezebel. It just has to be one person. And you're demoral. You're just crushed to your soul. You run to the cave, hoping to hear God's voice, and then God says to you, I'm now connected back to you, and I'm going to pull you through this so you can go back and face Ahab. So vision has to have a certain level of resiliency. It also has to be really hungry. It has to be hungry. You have to be hungry to be able to make church vision grow. You have to be hungry for God. And in fact, if you don't go through any hard times, you don't understand what it is to be hungry. If you live in the lap of luxury in your church and everything is just hunky-dory, it's because you're lying to yourself or something's going on really well right under your nose and you don't understand it. You actually need to be confronted by something really difficult. You need to be able to understand that God is not looking for heroes. He really is looking for shepherds. He's looking for someone who's going to be a follower more than anything else. So, to have vision, to understand vision, and how to do that, is not to have all the answers, because that's God who has all the answers. It's to trust that God has all the answers. That's what it means to be human for us. Our second question is this, create change. And when do we create change is always a very important question, and I'm constantly learning when to create change, which is actually all the time. There's a couple of metaphors, so let me share these couple of metaphors with you, and maybe they'll help you. If you wanted to create great wine, which often you do, don't tweet that. Everybody's like, oh my goodness, I bet you drink 6 kegs a day. No. If you want to create great wine, there's a process to be able to do this. You take the juice and you let the juice settle. And as the sediment settles down, you pour off that and until a little bit of sediment follows through. And then you let that settle for a long period of time. And once it's settled, you take it and you shake it again because you pour it off. So you have the solid stuff that has made the grape juice really beautiful, and that has weight to it, but it has to sink and has to be separated from the liquid. And you do this process. So as things become calm in your church, you shake it up a little bit. As it becomes calm in your church, you shake it up a little bit. Don't let them be comfortable. Don't let them feel like everything's done. It's just shake it up a little bit. Make them feel that change is part of the standard operating procedure for the church.
Yes.
That there is no office, no department, nothing that has to be as it is forever. This is only temporary. Always. I'm temporary, so are you. In some cases, I want to encourage you to be temporary. But yeah, everything is constantly moving. You want to encourage that. And the second metaphor, obviously, is the famous one that we all recognize, you know, from conception to birth. A little bit of change takes place, right? You know, a little bit of change from that little thing to this baby that comes out too large. And then you've got from birth all the way through to adulthood, tons of change taking place, and we watch it with our kids growing up, and the aches and pains, and their aggression and issues that they've got to work through because they got it from their mother. All of these things.
She's not here.
I could say, you need change. I could say that. And then, of course, you know, as they grow older and we grow older, we were looking for partners and we're experiencing change all the time. And then we get married. This is a pet peeve of mine. And because I sit down with lots of different couples who have issues in their marriage. And what they are, what they really want all the time is they want it to go back to the way it was. Because they don't want their partners to change. But their partners are going to grow. My goodness, if I was married to my wife, who, you know, we met when we were like 20, and if I'm married, if she was the same person today as she is back then, it would be weird, really creepy. And so, you know, you expect people to change, but you've got to embrace that I change and that she changes, because it's for better or for worse, not for sickness and health only, but actually for change that's taking place all the time. So you really want to encourage people to understand that change has to be standard operating procedure, which then begs the question, why do we have a church manual? It's the dummy's guide for church. That's what it is, the church manual. It's basically telling you this. If you don't know how to do church, somebody sat in a room and worked it out for you. But if you do know how to do church, take what's here, build on it, and make something new. The church manual is not the Bible. It is just a suggestion to you how to build the structure. I once went to this church, 600 seats in this church, and my wife and I went to this church, and I was preaching there for the Sabbath morning, and I turned up, and that meant that there were four people total in the church. So I said to them, you know, why don't I just sit down here at the table together, and we'll just, you know, do church in the foyer, on the lobby. And they said, no, Pastor. There's a pulpit up there. And I said, really? That means there's three people here and I'm here? Yes. And so I went up, climbed up into this pulpit to preach down to these people, my wife and two other people. And whenever we sang a hymn, the lady got up and she went to the organ and played it like there were 600 people in the church. The entire community could feel the entire thing taking place. And then we then sat down and, do you want a children's story next? I mean, it's just kind of a weird experience growing up with this church at this moment. But here's the thing, you know, we go to nominating committee and we just feel like we've got to do things because it says it's got to be done this way. We've got to have like 4,000 different officers and we only have 6 members. Everybody take on lots of positions. And it's crazy. It's crazy. The church manual's there to encourage you to think. And you do need to think, and as you think, you will grow and change will take place. Change is really, really large. You know, coming to Christ, sometimes for us, we think it's just a very clever little series. I read this book by a particular chap who said, if anybody's got these 15 excuses as to why they don't give their life to Christ, here are the 15 things that you can say to them to convince them. So if they say, I don't like pink, you say this. I don't like blue, you say this. Very manipulative, right? Because they think that it's just a matter of convincing somebody with enough psychology to convince them that they're going to follow Christ. Following Christ is not us who does this. Jesus is the one who converts people. So if people are not being converted, who's failing? The success rate is really scary for people because we're really uncomfortable with it. But yet, we use language all the time. Language like weeping events. Seriously, really, the vocabulary needs to change. Are we farmers? Really? I mean, this is a weeping event now. In fact, I applied to my conference, I'm not saying it's Rocky Mountain Conference, I applied to my conference for evangelism funds, and they explained to me that really, evangelism funds are just for weeping events. And I was like, so all these ideas, all these things that we as a local congregation would like to do, none of them qualify for any funding.
None of it, Jay.
From the conference to be able to do this kind of stuff. Danny and I had the same kind of conversation, and we're just like, surely there are other ways to do what you would call weeping events. I tell you, change is really heavy and change is really huge, but where it comes from, it will cause some things to change in our lives as well. So when people come to Christ, they understand there's huge changes, and yet those huge changes could take an entire lifetime to do, and yet we expect it to be done overnight really quickly, just as it's done. We talk of the past as if it was the great days. You know, when I arrived at Boulder Church, People came and explained to me, you know, many times, there was a day when the church was good. Now, look at you, it's not. You know, and they would explain this over and over again. You know, there was a day when we did this and we did that, and it was just amazing. You know, church was never great in the past. Church was never great. Unless, of course, you're talking the past all the way back to Adam and Eve before they ate from the tree. And unless you're talking about that, then the past is not our model. The future is where we are right now. The present is where we are right now. We have to find a way to redefine that. Jesus understood this. The Jews, when they were in exile, they looked back and they looked at it and said, God, if only we could be like Solomon. That's what they really longed for. But they misunderstood what God was calling them to, a new future, a new way, and the Messiah who was going to come. And Adventism has struggled with this a long time. We really do believe in some kind of 1940s Adventism that was just, you know, everything was black and white and really simple and everybody looked the same, you know. And somehow we believe that was a good day. That was a great day. Everybody was converted. If it was such a great day, then why are we losing so badly right now? And why are we failing so now? So strength is really important, and to be able to do this, we actually do need to recognize that change has to be done all the time. We have to embrace it. Question number three is probably the harder one. That's one that we face. Creating metrics for church. What? This is a really difficult one because we all have ideas of how to evaluate whether church is doing really well or not. Last night at the Advance Conference, Michael Connect mentioned the ABC. I'd never heard the ABC before. I'd always heard the AB, but not the C. And he said that it's attendance and baptism and cash. Yes. And that's how you evaluate things. And you know, I went to my evaluation with the conference, and they have the reports from all the elders and the vision board about how I'm doing as a pastor, and they talk to me about those results in particular. And then they ask me the classic questions. You know, how's your attendance, and how's your baptism? Right. And you know, you only had two baptisms this year. And so what's going on with that? And because that's what we actually know, and that's how we're going to decide whether it's going good. The difficulty is this. There's nothing wrong with counting. There's nothing wrong with counting. In fact, actually, it's very easy to be able to do that. If you can count it, you might as well just count it. I count everything. I'm really into numbers, so I count absolutely everything all the time. The difficulty is that it's not maybe the best metric always. Here. What's your return for investment for Twitter? They're looking for all the tweets they can get. So they're counting all the time. So for Twitter, counting is really important. First Facebook, counting is really important. For any supermarket, counting is really important. For the stock market, counting is really important. For the Apple computers, counting is really important. They know that, and everybody understands this, and we embrace that. But God doesn't live for counting. How many people does he say, I wonder how many people are circumcised today? Or today, I guess he would say, how many people are baptized? Does God feel that there's only success when people are baptized? Is that when he feels that everything is going well inside there? And we look at it in our church because we love baptism. We like attendance. It's really, really good. But God is saying, maybe there's something else. What if somebody becomes Baptist instead of Adventist? Is that 1-0? Or 0-1? You know, what if somebody goes to another Adventist church just a stone's throw away from you? Is that success for God, or is that not? These are difficult questions that we don't want to actually have to address, because if we do, we'd actually have to talk to God about it. And with this list, we understand that it actually does make it easy to quantify things all the time. I mean, we look at other religions, we look at Buddhism and Hinduism and Islam, and we're like, but Christianity, 2 billion. Yes, we must be right, because numbers mean that you're doing well, like Napoleon and Mussolini and Hitler, because the majority understands what it's like to be right, right? Because that's all that counts. If you get enough people at the table, then you must be right. And you know, if you've ever read or seen the scripts that have been done by Hitler, I mean, they're pretty darn phenomenal. They're great speeches. I've got this book in my office of the great speeches of the world, and I read this one by Hitler where he talks about a coat, and he has this foot soldier's coat on it. He says, you see this coat? I am you. We together, we will be this people. And he says, I will wear this coat until we win. And people are like, yes, he's just like us. Because everybody wants to hear a preacher tell them that they're just great. Everything's fine. And we are very focused on that. And we love this all the time. We love our egos to be stroked and for everybody to feel that we are the same way inside here. But the big point that we forget is that we are broken people. And as broken people, we are not the point of church. We are not the standard by which church should be judged at or decide whether it's actually good or worth finding or whether we actually should be trusting it. Numbers will always exist. I take a photo of my church every week. Not the back of the heads, the front of the heads, like this. If we were right now, I would have a camera right here and I take a photo of my entire congregation. The reason I take a photo of them is because I have to report to Rocky Mountain Conference the attendance of the church. And so I do that. Then what I do on Monday, staff meeting, I'll zoom into that 4K image and I'll say, oh, Bob's here. Where's two? That's what people feel. No, I don't do that. I'm looking at the picture. Actually, you know, when I first started taking photos, this is what people would do in the congregation. I'm not saying Kelly Lee. But you know, they're like, I'm opposed to this. But eventually we just hit the camera and we just take photos anyway. So we take photos because we need to report the numbers, and it's really important. But the other thing that I actually am able to see when I look at these photos is to be able to track who's coming to church and who's not coming to church. And you know, it is nice to be able to see that kind of stuff taking place. And I do enjoy it. It's not a problem. I enjoy when Create grows. And we sell out. I enjoy it when the one project grows and we sell out. It's a fantastic feeling. It's kind of, for our Adventist pastors, it's the caffeine product or the white dust. It's just the stuff that says, this is the rush that we need, right? This is the stuff that says, this is the amazing things that we have because, oh, isn't it great that we have so many people coming? And honestly, as I watch, you know, you're preaching a series and you watch more and more people come, you start to feel, maybe I'm doing something good. Right? Because that's what church is about, isn't it? Yeah, that's what it's about. It's about me feeling good. About me making sure that I have enough people here. That's what it's about. That's what we do, and that's what we love to do. But in truth, church maybe is a little bit more than that. On Wednesday night, I was with Steve Case and a group of his doctoral students last Wednesday, and we were discussing different things inside there, and I was asking them about what they believe metrics are. One doctoral student said this. He said that he can't explain to his conference that two youth that he has in his church have decided to stay. Okay? They didn't leave. They decided to stay. And that's success. Amen. But how do you report that? The five people I have, they're here still. You should be happy. I could have had four. But it's true, because if you know those people, if they have faces and they're people to you, the fact that they stay is huge. And yet there is no bonus for that. Instead, bonus in some countries, and you know, I know this happens in Peru and it happens in South America and certain countries in Africa, you know, if you baptize enough people, you get a pay rise at the end, you get a bonus, you get a brand new suit, you get vacation, all these things. So you baptize 300 people, you go down the Amazon River, come back, you said, I baptized 400 people, I don't know where they are, but I did baptize them. Well done. Here's your bonus. Go have a holiday in Hawaii. Come back. Baptize the same 400, because I couldn't remember the names last time. And let's just go ahead. And I'm actually doing this because intense pressure is to not report this. When I was a child, I don't know if you ever had this, but did you ever have in the middle of the worship service and Sabbath school where they would have somebody say, now, who's been witnessing this week? Oh my goodness, it was embarrassing. You know, there'd always be one brother who did all the witnessing for the entire world, right? Yeah, I've been in gathering every day, all through the night, and I've done 5,000 tracks, and everybody else is like, I haven't done anything. Can I die in this chair and just hide? And so then eventually it went away because we only had one response. But it is that pressure to report all the time and to be able to say, hey, everything is going good, but God is saying, hey, there's got to be something deeper inside this. So the most difficult thing that I have is to preach at my church. Preaching is not my gift set, so preaching is a very difficult thing for me to be able to do this. And what I did at the church was a really bad idea. When I arrived there, I created a survey for them to evaluate me every week. Oh, my goodness. I need to see a therapist after this. And so the survey would come in, and usually only three or four of them would fill it in, and they were mean. I mean, they would like blah, 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 about all sorts of stuff, nothing to do with the sermon, but I felt it was just about the sermon. And so it started to crush me. So after 6 months, I just deleted the survey. I said, oh, no, my system lost it. And some elder said, hey, where's the survey? I said, well, I don't know, who are you? And so it was just too painful to be able to take. And it's difficult because, you know, you want to go do ministry, the things that you feel more comfortable in, but yet I need about 40 hours to be able to write a message. And the problem is that I love to do the job, so when I do preach, I have to make sure I do 40 hours, plus I have to do all the other things that I actually really love to do. So what I do in church instead is I'll do some administration instead because I love that instead. Because every now and again, I get a member who will send me a video. They'll send me a video from some church, and I'll say Flatirons. Mega church down the road, and the guy's got a 6-pack or 400-pack and a t-shirt and stuff, and he's up there, and they're like, can't you just preach like this? Huh. And I'm like, actually, no, with Chuck. Yeah, no, I can't. You want the hipster cool, that kind of pastor? I don't know, just go and import one from Japan. I don't know, it's just I can't do that, right? Because that's what they want. Some of them desperately need to have this person, this kind of performance, this kind of like charisma. And I'm like, I'm not that kind of preacher. And you want that kind of preacher? I understand that, because you come to church expecting somebody to grab you and drop off the doctoral thesis and at the same time make you laugh the entire time. Right? You expect pastors to write as if they're publishing a New York bestseller every week. And you know the kind of pressure that's on their head? When they're thinking, I found the word of God, I'm excited about him, I actually want to translate this, but I don't know if I have the right words exactly to do this in the best way. And so you're constantly judging yourself. So for me, one of the most difficult things to do is to do that. So I run from it. What I do instead is I do things that I'm really good at, which is administration, planning, organizing, putting all that kind of effort into visitation, that kind of stuff. And I love that, and that's fine. And so I create structures in the church to implement this and to make this kind of stuff go together. And that's what I try to do in the church as well. As a metric, I create structures. Well, we created 4 elders' councils. I tried to move the power of decision-making from the vision board that deals with the big stuff, the vision stuff, to actually the practical stuff that takes place with the elders' board. So we created 4 councils of elders. And these 4 councils of elders, one for administration, one for worship, one for teaching, and one for community, they all have a lead elder inside there. They meet and they discuss and they dream things up all the time, which is phenomenal. But they don't make decisions to move things often. Right? So next Saturday, a couple days from now, that's one of the things I'm going to be talking to them about. Time to actually change the church again. Time to just like mix it up a little bit and make great wine, non-alcoholic, of course. You know, it's time to be able to move the metaphor and the needle a little bit, because you want to be able to do that. And I'm constantly saying to them, we need to be kind of people who are willing to try something new. So in my church, I'm a strong believer in this, and maybe you feel the same way. Ministry should be done in twos. We've got that. In Jesus. I don't know. I don't know why we always send pastors off one by one and say, good luck, see you 400 years later, and enjoy that experience out there with those sheep, and just have fun. No, Jesus said go 2 by 2 for a particular reason that he understood. There's tremendous energy and wealth of talent and accountability when you work in teams. So we took all our money and we squeezed it all together. We basically have no money to be able to eat, but we do have enough money to have 4 pastors. Right, that's what we did. We said, we're not going to have anything else. We're going to have instead my vision board take a phone call. He's the chair of the vision board. That boulder. He's probably saying, NASA, launch. Actually, he's in charge of public health for which county? Jefferson County? Yeah, so he's probably saying, yes, I ate the fries. So, you know, we really do want us to be able to say, hey, we've got to try even better to be able to move our church into a place where we have people. Now, I really believe in pastors working in teams, and so we have a youth pastor, and a young adult pastor, and a worship pastor, and a senior pastor, all together. We live together. We go to the church together. We work together, and we dream together, because it's really important to work in community. Without a budget for anything else, but at least we're together, and we get a lot of strength and energy by supporting each other through that. So I encourage that. We're also very important about, you know, administration, about marketing. And so we immediately, as soon as I arrived in Boulder, we bought, you know, Twitter account, Boulder Church, Instagram, Boulder Church. I don't know why none of the other churches, all 50, 60 of them, none of them bought it. We bought the website as soon as .church came out. We're boulder.church, that's our website. We went and got all of it, because what we want, when people Google Boulder Church, they find us. Eventually, we will be number one there. Eventually, we'll be number 10 as well, and 9, and 8, and 7, because we want to be the place that people will find when they're looking for God, for church, for some kind of community inside there. So systems are really my wheelhouse. I love it, all right? But systems are not the metric of success in the church. Systems are easy. You're stuck in doing systems, call me and I'll show you. It's really easy to do systems. But that's not the metric that God is looking for. There's a great book by Patrick Lencioni called The Advantage. It came out a few years ago. I really encourage you to read it. He talks about how what you're looking for in business is to be healthy. And it's very hard to quantify healthy, right? And I want my church, I want your churches to be a healthy church. That's what we're looking for. And to be healthy means that we actually need to move away from just systems, but we actually need to move it to a place where we're creating space so that people can actually grow. Start with whoever is willing. That's what I do. Whoever is willing to start, then you do that, because that's what's really important. We created a list of everybody in our church, and we call them partners. We're not calling them members, we're calling them partners. Everybody who comes and partners with our mission and vision, they are part of our partners list. And the elders meet together, and we go through the 450 names, because our people, they attend church once or twice a month. There's a few who come every week, but most of them come once or twice, because they're, I don't know, skiing in Aspen, or climbing some Long's Peak Mountain, which is a really bad idea. But they're out all the time, and so they rotate around. So they never get to really build strong community. They wonder why they come to church and like, people just, I just can't build friendships up in church. Well, you come once a month. Let me see how your marriage goes if you've got to see each other once a month. Hey, good luck. You know, parent from distance aside there. So we do go through these names of all the partners, and we're looking for the way to be able to engage them inside this, inside their life. And in engaging them inside their lives, we're looking for a ways to engage them inside worship. We're looking for ways to engage them inside with the youth this summer. We're going to do an internship with them and try and get 5 kids to actually spend their entire summer with us as pastors and learn how to do life as well. I mean, Jesus focused on 12 disciples, right? But he really only cared about 3. And the 3 that he really cared about, extra care, sorry, it sounded like he didn't care about the other 9, but if you looked at them, maybe. He realized that there is something powerful about creating small bubbles of community, powerful creating small teams that actually get to do this stuff. And so we're trying to create healthy space. We're trying to create forums where faith is discussed inside there, bringing in the right kind of ideas and into discussions that will take place inside it. And from there, we believe that it is going to affect the entire global church as well. Hence, inside our church, we have Eli King, who's our worship pastor, who writes a song for the gathering that he practices at our church. And then he'll sing it and lead it in our church. Hence, inside our church, one of our youth pastors, we're down to the final 2, will lead Generation One for the One Project, and will lead it actually globally eventually for the entire One Project, all over the place, creating space for youth. Hence, our young adult pastor, Jessica Albert, will actually eventually lead our young adult chapter that we were creating inside the One Project in San Diego. So we believe that the local church is a place that you can birth great ideas, but you have to have a testing ground. You have to have a place where it's real and you connect to people and learn this kind of stuff. If you don't, you will feel that things start to move away too quickly away from there. Pushing ahead is very difficult. And with that metric, you know, you want to be able to feel that God is with you every single step of the way. When I chose Boulder Church, it was a difficult decision to choose. Difficult because of my family. I asked my wife, who, you know, had a career at Andrews University as a professor, was in the middle of a PhD program. She super qualified, has a great community, had a great Sabbath school faculty that she enjoyed visiting, had friends that she went walking with every Sabbath morning, and everything that was going well for her. But I just had this deep urgency and dissatisfaction that I needed to go back to a local congregation. I needed it. Not everybody does, but I needed. So she sacrificed all of it. People made promises to us to come to Boulder. Those promises have fallen away. Things have been a bit difficult and awkward and hard in some places, but we have pressed on with it. And my wife is being strong through it. My kids are enjoying the church, and that's huge. That's huge. It's huge when my youngest boy, Jonah, he goes to school at Vista Ridge Academy, and there's a teacher there called Sandy who's just amazing. That you can't put value on that. It's huge, you know, when you've got members in your church like Jim and Janelle Fazio, like Mark and Diane Johnson, and Jan and Gordy Gates, and Peter and Patty Chamberlain, who have invested in our lives. And the, you know, there's loads of other great people, but these are people who I really connected to. I felt a kindred spirit with them. And they invested in my kids, and they've invested in our lives. And it's huge. You can survive all sorts of things when you belong to a great community that understands this. And it can take you through all sorts of difficult things when you do that kind of stuff. But that still is not enough to create church, right? Which brings us to our fourth and final question, why do we create churches? And I've asked people many times what it is, the reason why we do this. Some will say community, yes? A lot of community. Some will say friendship. Some will say women. Some will say men. Some will say because of blessings. Some will say because of the food. Some will say because of leadership. Some will say because of the good food. It's very important to have good food at the church. But is that enough of a reason to actually create church? We have created a culture of bunny hoppers who jump from one church to the next church because they're dissatisfied with actually committing to one congregation. And they're just like, you know, I have some young guys in my church here that are just like, oh, so-and-so is speaking here, and they're over there. And I'm like, you, over here, you have lost out on building real community in your church. You need to understand this is your family. It's not temporary. It's not like you're pretending to be married and you're living together and saying, well, I'm kind of married. You've got to be committed to that marriage inside. So there's a great text in the Bible in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, as I wrap this up, chapter 12. 12 to 20, where it talks, and most of us would read this text and would say, this is about the gifts that all of us have, and everyone has a role, and that's where we get the term members, which is really good, and we use that, which, by the way, we do need to reevaluate membership in the church desperately. Our theology or policy about what a member is needs to be sat down, and we need to look at that, because we have some really serious inconsistencies as to what we decide a member is, and some really weird criteria as well with that, because I do not baptize people into Adventism, and we have to discuss what that really means. But there's a deeper layer inside this text here, because Paul is referring to Genesis chapter 1 to 2. He's referring to the creativity that God has done by creating human beings. He says the human body is this example of creativity inside this. In fact, he doesn't even refer to Jesus. He refers to the Messiah in this text, this idea, because he says, look, the Jews were looking for the Messiah. And even David, when he went against Goliath, he was representing Israel. And he's trying to say the Messiah is what it's actually all about. To be living in the Messiah because of the power of the Holy Spirit is to be the church. So then he uses the metaphor of the body, which everybody thinks Paul created, but actually everybody else used at the time. And he just copied it. And he said, well, it's like the body. And everybody's like, yeah. But in those days, they understood the body to be the head was the emperor, and everybody else was the taxpayer. And God's saying to them, no, I'm going to tell you something else. The body's entirely different here. And so when you get in the text in verse 12, and it says, you think it's going to say, so it is. You know, when he talks about the church, the body, he then says, so it is with the church is what you're expected to say. But he doesn't say that. Instead, he says, so it is with Christ, with the Messiah. And what Paul is trying to say here is that the church is Jesus Christ. And we have to belong to this church because we belong to Jesus Christ. And so we would say that it is through baptism, absolutely. Not into Adventism, but actually into Jesus Christ. And we have responsibility that we take. And he talks about this metaphor again a little bit of all the different gifts and skills that we all have. Because people, and he mixes the list up on purpose all through the New Testament to basically say, there isn't a high or low on this stuff. You want to categorize everything because you do. But in fact, actually, all of them are valuable. When it comes to being church, the purpose is not actually about us. It's actually about us belonging to Jesus Christ. It's about us being the body that blesses the whole world.
Thank you, Japheth. You realize that none of us would be here without Japheth de Oliveira. Are you aware of that? That's not just something nice to say. I mean, if Tim and Sam, we would not be here without this leadership. So thank you for that strength, but also for some real vulnerability in the last half an hour. Very meaningful, for sure. And because you're so open and vulnerable, Rod, do we have the picture again? Yeah.
Okay.
We just should leave that picture up for just a little while. If you look at sweet little Jay there.
My wife and I are going to have a discussion.
What's that in your hand right there?
It's a gun.
It's like a little James Bond. What's in the other hand over there? Is that
a little car?
A little car? So sweet.
Hey, Rod.
Mark.
First of all, I want to apologize for the telephone call. My 9-month-old granddaughter calling to thank me for the Valentine's.
Yes. Of course it would be.
I'm not sure how to keep this succinct, but I will try my best. One of the bars that was missing on your slide, Alex, was the slide of medical ministers in the church.
Come on.
We have in this church numerous. If Ellen White was here, she would want that bar there, because when she looked at the church, she said, the preachers of the word and the medical ministers are the same. They're preaching the gospel. They need to work together. It is time for us to get past Battle Creek and to go back to the General Conference of 1888, where a preacher and a physician brought the beginning of the loud cry to this church, and it has not gone forward. And since Battle Creek, we have gone in different directions. In college, we were all together. And I don't mean to be judgmental, but at least when I was in college, it was not the best and brightest that went to Amity. It was the best and brightest that went to Loma Linda. We went to Loma Linda and we learned to question, to think, to challenge. We came back together and met our colleagues in our churches. They had gone to Andrews, they came back and they had memorized the manual. And we didn't have the great deal of trust and respect that we should have had for them, and they did not trust us at all. And the leadership of the church loved us because we were distributors of brochures in our offices and bringers in of tithe, and they didn't think we were doing the gospel. They didn't know what we were doing out there. And part of it was because they couldn't control us. And so they feared us. And it's time for us to get past that. Come back together. They told us that we should, after we work all day in our clinics, come and do projects that we had at the church. This is what we should do. And I have learned that the word should is a useless word. It is something that is just not relevant. That there needs to be a better reason. We need to get back to understanding that when Christ was working at the carpenter's bench, he was doing God's service just as much as when he was working, healing, and preaching. That everybody has a ministry, and what we need from our leaders in the churches is teach us better how to integrate this ministry we have at the carpenter's bench or in our offices. Teach us how to integrate that into the fact that we're seeing patients, or that we're making chairs. That's what we need, and we don't have.
Good.
Beautiful.
Thank you. No, I was going to put that on the bar graph, but it would dwarf all the others. If you actually look at the data, it struck me that the majority of employees of the Seventh-day Adventist Church are not Adventist, by far, if you track with what I'm saying. You put all the hospitals, that's how the data reads, and it's interesting about how that all plays. Thank you, Mark. Yes? Thank you. Yeah, Patty just reminded me to make sure you introduce yourself so that everyone knows who you are. Next.
Since nobody's yet, no, I'm Danny again. So it's interesting in the context of membership, we had a lady who emailed us not too long ago. She says, I've repeatedly asked to have my membership dropped from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I'm very involved in a non-denominational church right now, so I won't be coming back to your church. Could you take care of that for me? I'm not a clerk. You know, it was like one of the first times that I was on eAdventist, that wonderful thing. And I went in there to try to, and I found out that the only way to drop her is to mark her as apostasy. So I had two choices. I was either to apostatize her,
or kill her,
or to mark her as missing. But she's not missing because I know where she's at. But I marked her as missing because I couldn't apostatize her. You know, so. This is the kind of thing that we have created that sends a really, really, really bad message.
Anybody else? Who are you?
My name is Bill Cork, live in Houston, Texas, but work for Adventist Chaplaincy Ministries for the North American Division. And on the idea of vision that I'd like to jump off of, sometimes it's a matter of us just opening our eyes to what is right in front of us. Now, we talked about this tension between ministry and healthcare, but nobody mentioned last night those ministers that are part of our healthcare system that we call chaplains. People that have the title of chaplain or director of pastoral care or director of vision and ministry, people like Steve King and Mark Stoddart and Jim Feldbusch and Theo Stewart and how many more that we could mention, that we are working together and it is one ministry. And I think we have to acknowledge that. Also, an example, I grew up in a town called New Haven, Connecticut. Went to a church on Humphrey Street, two blocks from the Yale University campus. And that church never had a vision for campus ministry. When I was a youth in Sabbath school, I had Ernie Bursey as my Sabbath school teacher when he was working on his PhD there. That kind of person was welcomed. But I preached there a couple of years ago, and they said, you know, in the history of our church, you're the first pastor that's ever said that we might have a vision to this very neighborhood that our church is in, to kind of key into Lisa's point. So I don't think we have to go searching for some grand vision. Sometimes it's just open our eyes to what's right in our own backyard.
No, that's good. And I wonder, just thinking about what Tim had to say and Lisa had to say and now what Jason said about measurements, if we need to establish those local measurements proactively, in other words, instead of having some external metric put on us, sometimes we just need to be proactive. I think, you know, sometimes that actually makes I don't want to say it makes everybody happy, but I think that sometimes the proactivity of saying, this is what we want to do at Yale. This is the measure of success that we have, and I think sometimes that can be positive.
I just got a comment on that. My name's Dale. I'm from Battleground. Comment on the baptism issue, I guess. I had the privilege and, I guess, a huge challenge of being part of the church plant about 12 years ago or so. And we had, of course, a lot of oversight from the conference about that. And the issue of baptism came up. Because we were just basically, throw it all out, so we're just going to build it back up one step at a time and see why do we do everything we do. And this whole issue of baptism, whether we're baptized into a church or baptized into Christ. And of course, well, you're baptized into Christ, but you have to be into a church too. I asked the question, I said, what would happen if someone made the decision to be baptized and you brought them to the church and you asked for a vote? And they said no. Are you giving the church the authority to say this person can't be baptized into Christ? Now, we've never seen that happen. But the way it's set up now, potentially, it could happen that way.
My name's Stephen. I'm from Walla Walla University. 9 years ago, I came off the streets. I was a homeless guy. And the pastor at the Hickey Church took me in, and I said, I have felt the call since I was 8 years old to serve God. I don't know if I want to be an Adventist. Maybe I do. Will you baptize me into Jesus? At some point in my life, I believe I'm supposed to be an evangelist to the world. What this pastor did was he allowed me to be baptized, and not only that, he confirmed my calling by allowing me to lead out at the church in a discussion group that happened every week after church. 9 years later, I'm still here, and I think I know the reason why. If we as the Adventist church have the right answers, we have to quit preaching a message of control and fear and start trusting that if we baptize people into Jesus and they get the Holy Spirit in their life, if we have that same spirit in us, they'll come up with the same answers that we have. And so we just have to quit being afraid. And I want to say something about the whole educational process of going to Loma Linda and Andrews and the Brightest Mind. Let me tell you something. I was pastoring a church as a lay minister and serving tables 3 years after being an alcoholic. A pastor in a church with a vision said, you have a call to ministry, and put me in charge of a church. I was there for 2 years. I served tables, and I led a little church of 25 people. By the end of that 2 years, I'll just say this last thing. There was a lady who came to my church who was a Pentecostal. She asked me to go down to the Catholic hospital to pray for her mother. I went to that hospital on the way. I didn't know what to say. God gave me 5 verses. That was the same 5 verses she had been praying for her children for her entire life. How could I have known that? That woman had her memorial service in our church. That Sabbath, there was 300 people packed out in that church. Most of them were Catholics. If you get baptized into Jesus and let the Holy Spirit lead, and as a church we move away from fear, and we move towards love, and we let God lead, people will come up with the same answer. And guess what that answer is? God is love. Let them in. They're his children. Beat them.
Anyone else? One more. Is there another? I've never done that. That looked awkward. It's because I've never done that. It's interesting that when we talk about metrics in church world, it's almost about internal metrics. And I forget who, someone in this room will know, but I did some reading a couple of years ago that why is my metric not we're going to change the literacy rate in Walla Walla County? Why is the metric not that we are going to change the homelessness rate in Walla Walla County? See, the metrics are often internal metrics. How about external metrics, the kind that, you know, I think Lisa and Tim touched on, to say, hey, we're actually going to move some important numbers in our community. Now that, I mean, that becomes the kind of metric that I think people can be excited about. Tim?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. If, you know, if you're from a public health background, you work in metrics all the time. But that has become a very, in my opinion, and Mark, you may desperately disagree with me, and you know way more than I do, so just keep it to yourself until these people leave. But it seems that the fight or the seeking after those kind of metrics has created like a programmatic intervention system that works on grants to work on this metric. When that metric goes down, the grant dries up, and then that metric kind of goes back up. We see that in the public health world. So as we look at external metrics, which I think are really important, and I think the data is available out there, we have to make sure we're choosing to approach those metrics in a relational way as opposed to a programmatic way, or we're kind of back exactly where we are doing different programs. They're not revelation seminars, but they're something else. But if the relational aspect isn't tied to those metrics, then we have a real problem.
Let's have Sam. Let's have Sam come up because we've got Sam right. Look, Jesus tells us a story of a parable, and in that parable, he said that there was seed, and the seed was scattered through the ground, and 25% success rate was actually very acceptable for Jesus. Maybe what we have to do is be careful about how we judge each other, about the territory that we're working in. Maybe we have to be more cognizant that there are some fields that are harder than others. When I was at Andrews University and I started a church, I had 600 people tomorrow. It was very easy. When you're in another situation where you don't have the community, it's a very different thing. So you may think you have success because people come to you and because they're in your seats. But thumbs on the seats, quite candidly, doesn't mean that they're followers of God. So we gotta think deeper about what God has called us to and what metrics God is looking for, rather than just I'm not saying don't count. I'm not saying don't report that stuff. I'm just saying that it's far deeper than that. Now, we've got so much more to do. And
I've got good news. That's
good.
I'm gonna share.
Good news. It's called the gospel.
Anyone here from San Diego? Okay, so the church in San Diego has identified the 90,000 people that the American government has planted there from all over the world where there are bad things happening. Okay, they have decided to minister to those 90,000 people with things like literacy, gardens, all those kinds of things. You ask if they're having baptisms from those 90,000. No. But they're having baptisms from people who have come beside them and said, we think that what you're doing is really cool. Can we help? They've had over 300 baptisms.
Wow. All right. We're going to move to Sam.
Hey, everybody. Aren't you tired? I'm tired of sitting and listening. You're not? Okay, good. So, they always put me at the end of these things, towards the end, because they know I panic the longest. And I don't know why. This is torture. Thank you. When you do a comment card later today, just say, please put Sam first next time. Hear him. Thanks, guys. Let's do a standing exercise so you get some exercise. How many of you have worked at a college or university? Just stand. Would you? How many of you presently are working at a college or university? Sit down if you're not. Yeah, okay, awesome. Wow, okay. How many of you have attended an Adventist university or college? Stand. Okay, you may have a seat. Thank you. How many of you have kids right now who are attending? Some of you are going to get some exercise today. Oh, okay. How many of you have kids going soon? There you go. I need to be at least one. Wow, okay, wow. How many of you are paying on student loans right now that you accrued when you were a student? Some of you will be, that's right. How many of you...
Any have student loans that are not paid?
How many of you received, this is really super sensitive, how many of you received the denominational discount while you were a student? Oh, stand, just stand. Go ahead, so everyone else can judge you. You had it easy. You had it easy. Okay, okay, thank you for standing. Yeah. Anyone not stand at all through any of those questions? Seven of you. Two of you. So this may be, the stuff I'm going to say may be completely foreign to you, not applicable, so you can nap, get on your phones, play some games, Facebook. Actually, it'll be applicable. I graduated from Southern Adventist University, I attended Andrews, and I now work at Lassier University. That's my trajectory in Adventist higher ed. And I'm going to spend a couple minutes, and I really mean just a couple of minutes, throwing some things on the table that I think we should discuss. Okay? And I'm going to speak, it's going to be brief, so we can have more time for discussion. All right. Brief and exciting history of Adventist higher ed. I'm going to the entire history of the Adventist educational system. You ready? 1874, Battle Creek College founded. This is the first class of 1876. Look at them. They're awesome. There wasn't enough women, so one guy went home single. Who do you think it was? That's terrible. In the same year, this is really interesting, 1874, first college, that was 11 years after we began as a denomination officially. In the same year, we sent out our first missionary, 1874. I don't think it's an accident or a coincidence that the year we got serious about starting a college, we also got serious about mission outreach. Both went together. So we knew what higher ed was for, and we knew what missionaries were for. That was clear. Right, we knew that.